If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me, as always, is my co-host, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
That's me. I'm doing well.
You seem to be forgetting that it's you. It seems to be a discovery every time.
I try to take on a different persona with my newly acquired brain cells that are reconnecting. I'm becoming a different person, Mark.
I am your co-host, Mark Bigney, and we're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to be talking about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intra-segment, the Eurus, what we reviewed last year. We're going to be talking about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to be closing it out with our topic, which is pulling levers. This is kind of a coda to our discussion last week. This is a further clarification on some of the things that, well, let's be frank, mostly I said. So as to make sure that everyone's on the same page, and so as that we are not to be misunderstood here at So Very Wrong About Games, because it is clear now that my words were taken very harshly, and that was not intentional, and for this I apologize. But we're going to be talking, broadly speaking, in games about the joy, the appropriateness, the effectiveness of just pulling levers to see what happens. Experimentation, improvisation, all manner of things of that nature. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly 1 year ago, Mark, we reviewed a game called Zuvadis, which is a reprint of a Reiner Knizia game, and they made a super wonderful deluxe version of this game.
Yeah, one of the problems that I had with Quo Vadis, the original, was every negotiation game needs to have enough grist for negotiation. And this typically relies on both the information state and the availability of resources. And Quo Vadis was open information, and the only thing that was there to negotiate, broadly speaking, was points and votes. It wasn't quite enough there. Usually, it's a perfectly functional game, but it tended to be relatively obvious what deals there were to be made, and there wasn't a lot of wheeling and dealing. Zuvadis introduced special character powers, and in a brilliant move, you got points for activating those powers, and by and large, those powers were activated for the benefit of other people. And that really just blew open the doors for what deals could be made and under what context. And I thought it was really a solid improvement over what was a functional but uninspired game. And Zuvadis, I think, is a marvelous, very, very light, but very satisfying negotiation game.
Yeah, so what you have is the anthropomorphic animals, and you have a group. Say you have some aardvarks. Everyone starts at the beginning, and there's all these different paths to get to the end. And you're sort of, everyone's voting each other forward. And you're trying to get your whole group to the end. And so you're wheeling and dealing, using these special abilities, trying to be the first person to get your whole group to the end of the map.
Well, at the same time, it has that lovely dual-barreled victory condition. In order to be eligible to win, you need to be at the end of the map. It doesn't matter whether you have one or whether you've got all of them. And then it's the most points of the people who are there. And so the initial placements don't tend to have a whole lot of tension, but right near the end, when it becomes clear that you might or might not be able to have the remaining spaces, that's when things start to get really wild. And I appreciate that even a game as simple and as light as Zuvadis is can have an arc. And like many games of its ilk that are very flexible in terms of how the tempo of the game can be arranged, tightness of those last spaces can vary considerably from game to game. And so it sees a fair amount of variability, even independently of the fact that there can be different factions in play.
Zuvadis.
Big fan of Zuvadis. Love that game.
That is the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago.
So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, you and I got Sky Team back to the table, and we used the new expansion. The new expansion is hilarious. We didn't do the Iceland runway where you have to chase penguins off the runway.
New Zealand. Close. Very close countries that are often mistaken for each other.
There's penguins in New Zealand.
In, yes, Southern Hemisphere.
Oh, yeah. I suppose there would be.
There are no penguins in the North, Walker, just the South.
So, we did not play the New Zealand runway.
Well, suffice to say there were zero penguins involved wherever we landed.
Which is unfortunate, because it sounds hilarious. But we did play with turbulence.
Yes.
What turbulence made us do is re-roll the dice every time we assigned one. And what that means is when you're playing Sky Team, you're trying to land a plane, and you're doing so by adjusting engines and brakes and clearing the skies of planes that are in your way. And so you look at your four dice and you need to program in a certain way. And what the turbulence does is after you play a die, you have to re-roll the dice you got. And I felt as though in our game, it just helped us out.
I agree. You were initially very daunted by the turbulence aspect. And I think I was the one who kept saying, no, actually, it's pretty good. It gives us many more opportunities to get the specific die rolls we want. Leaves you less able to plan how your entire round is going to go. But often you're reacting to what your partner's doing anyway. I find Sky Team fascinating because in the abstract, whenever I think about it structurally, I struggle to see what the game is, frankly, because you're placing four dice in a turn. Two of them are mandatory, and the other ones are often socked away towards other tasks that are mandatory, even though the placements aren't mandatory. You're going to need to do it sooner or later. And then on top of that, so many of the modules introduce additional forced placements. Like we played with fuel. You don't have to place in fuel every round, but you can't forsake it for too long. So you need to be socking away low dice at it. And yet, when I, you know, taking a step back from it, I don't see where the appeal is structurally from something like Sky Team. Playing the game is, I am presented with decisions. I'm presented with tough choices. I'm presented with prioritization issues. And I enjoy it a great deal.
Yes, because while you're doing this, you are not allowed to talk. So you have to somehow, by placing certain dice first, convey messages of what you have left behind your screen.
Right, and indicate through the cooperation with your partner what priorities they need to be exerting. So if you need to make sure that the plane levels out, for example, but all you have are high dice and the plane is already tilting towards you, well, you might sock away your lowest die there right away just to make sure that the that your colleague doesn't waste their high dice elsewhere. Issues like that. And a whole bunch of trade-offs and prioritization issues pile up, and eventually you're left with a somewhat interesting decision space and a whole lot of thematic interest.
And that's Sky Team, a great two-player cooperative game.
Sometimes, including penguins.
Designed by Luc Raymond and published by Scorpion Masqué.
Played a game called Ofrenda. Ofrenda is a review copy we got from the publisher Osprey Games.
And they're a friend of us.
Something like that. Good job, Walker. In Ofrenda, you will be building an ofrenda, which is basically a display to commemorate the dead, particularly for Dia de los Muertos in Mexico. And so there are sugar skulls and flowers and fancy paper decorations that are all meant to bedazzle this and make the spirits feel welcome and honored in this context. I say this because the art direction and the illustrations done by Alex Herrerias is really good, and all the cards, which represent different departed loved ones, are really well rendered. There's a lot of personality in them, and it really serves to communicate that you're building out this nice little display. Your tableau is a dual-layer cardboard board where you slot in the cards representing your family members. It looks pretty nice. It's got sort of the color vibes of a Dia de los Muertos celebration, and I very much appreciated that. And again, you're dealing with a lot of the traditional offerings of, like, the sugar skulls and the paper decorations. And it is very similar in terms of design pedigree and in terms of play feel to Calico. Everything is a scoring condition. And everything that you do might advance or foreclose some other scoring condition, because every family member has a condition under which they will become lit, which is basically scored. You don't score for unlit stuff, broadly speaking, but to light a candle for something, you need to satisfy the victory conditions on each individual family member. Now, some of them are much more straightforward to me. Like, for example, this card wants to be adjacent to two or more cards of the appropriate suit. Fine. You do that. You've done the job. You can move on to other things. Other ones, however, are more restrictive in the sense that, I'm not saying they're harder, but they are definitely less intuitive to me, and they cannot be next to anything of certain kinds of characteristics. These ones you might want to sock into the corner, because this is a tiered display of 12. Sock something into the middle, and that obviously is easier for it to be next to lots of things, as opposed to being socked in the corner, where it's easier to surround it with the cards that do not run afoul of its restrictions. On top of all of this, there are yet more victory conditions that you're drafting in the form of these candles, which are more global in nature, and then it's a whole thing. So I immediately got a similar sort of combinatoric vibe to Calico, because Calico is a tile laying game where every placement, again, might advance some scoring conditions, but forecloses others, and that's more or less all you do. And similarly, in Ofrenda, all you're doing is taking family members and occasionally these other victory conditions, these candles. So it's just victory conditions all the way down. It did not, however, cause me physical discomfort the way Calico did. It is very brain-burny, but not to an unpleasant degree. I think part of this is advanced considerably by the theming. I really like the theme. Calico is, it's like, oh, you're building a quilt defined exclusively by the fact that nothing matches. Okay, so you're making the theme out of the fact that there's no visual consistency to the things you're doing. Okay, and then cats show up because everyone loves cats. Fine. Look. Marketing genius works out very, very well. Not necessarily something that's a little more cohesive or visually interesting as far as I'm concerned. And I think that Ofrenda, although not exactly a thematic experience, I think it does a great job with its setting. And it gets a lot of mileage out of that. And the rule set, the fundamental rules are very simple. It's just a dizzying array of interlocking possible victory conditions. Scoring is also no joke, but that at least you only do at the very, very end. There's no in-game scoring in the middle of it. You can effectively, as a notation system, track which family members have satisfied the victory conditions and which ones haven't. But at the end of the day, we're talking about a lot of interlocking score elements that will lead into very easily into triple-digit scores. It wasn't complicated. It's just a little bit time-consuming. Fortunately, the intention is that every individual player gets a sheet from the score pad. There's not one global score pad. Everyone gets their own sheet for the score pad, and it's laid out the same way that your Ofrenda is, and so you just get to write in the numbers corresponding to each individual card as to how many points that it scores. So they knew what they were getting into, and they give you the necessary tools to offload it. Ofrenda is very much not my style of game. I strongly disliked Calico while at the same time respecting its design chops. But Ofrenda I very much prefer. It's not still not something that I would suggest all the time. But it is very good at accommodating people who want to do those hyper-puzzly, very, very thinky, combinatoric logic puzzles. But since the theming is well done and the actual rules of how to play your turn and even in the abstract how to score cards is pretty straightforward, it can accommodate gamers that are not necessarily that want to go knee deep into that. And since it's very multiplayer solitaire, you're not going to be stomping all over everyone's faces. So as far as drafting games go, I appreciate how much thinkiness it gets out of a relatively sparse rule set, and it moves at a reasonable clip, and everyone gets to have a delightful visual impact, but very much not my style of game. But I came away, similarly from Calico, impressed by the design chops behind Ofrenda. This was designed by Orlando Sa and Andre Santos, published by Osprey Games this year, Ofrenda.
So we got to play the game of the season, which is Galactic Cruise. This is designed by TK King, Dennis Northcott, and Colton Thompson, and put out by Kingston Key Games. And much like the title implies, you are building a spacecraft that is going to be a cruise ship, and you're sort of enticing guests to come onto this ship, and then you're taking them on a cruise and coming home. Meanwhile, you might be getting another ship ready. You might be getting fuel and food ready for that same ship to go out again. You're just constantly doing a churn to try to keep this combo engine going. And so if you were to put a Lacerda game at one end of a slide bar and theme at the other end, I would take the slide, I think, about 33% towards theme. Because it definitely had this Lacerda feel, but it just felt like the things you were doing made more sense. Like, of course, the ship needs food and fuel to run and, all the things you're doing, not just like, oh, you need a gear for a time machine because you need a gear. And it's like, oh, you thought you could go to the gear store? No, you need to, teach your offspring how to, make gears, and then in 4 generations, your gear store is up to full thrust, and now you can make gears for your time machine.
I agree that it is perhaps earning its comparisons to Lacerda designs. It's very much a sort of heavy Euro vein. One of the things that I appreciate about Galactic Cruise, though, when compared to Lacerda games or games of that ilk, is it's not really a whole bunch about combos. The game moves at a good clip. There's not a whole lot of downtime, and things are going along relatively well, which for multiplayer solitaire games, I think, is very much a plus. I really want to play it again. I'm not too sure about Galactic Cruise's longevity for me, because I enjoyed all the challenges of getting the resources together, but the game felt like it had two different periods. Period the first was before anyone was able to get a cruise ship up and running, because although it's not quite as convoluted or thematically incoherent as a number of Lacerda processes, it is somewhat time-consuming and difficult to get the blueprints, get the money to build the blueprints, get the advertising to get the patrons, and then get all the resources necessary to launch the cruise. This takes a while, so you're spending a number of turns just getting all the resources and getting all your ducks in a row, and then you've got a cruise ship. And then you populate the cruise ship and you send it off to space. And while it's in space, it just gets you a whole bunch of money and points and other good things. I felt my last half of the game was relatively uninteresting. All that I was doing was just getting the resources, launching ships, over and over and over again, because I wasn't really incentivized to do much else. Now, granted, getting the resource to launch a ship, I'm flattening a whole bunch of stuff. You know, there's different kinds of resources, there's money, there's advertising, then there's three different kinds of resources itself, and you have to go and kind of pre-reserve clients, and sure, I could have been trying to start an additional ship, maybe, to diversify things, but I didn't really see the point. And I think that subsequent plays might give me a better sense of the different pressures involved, because if it ends up feeling the same, within a given session of Galactic Cruise, I felt like the last few turns were kind of on autopilot, no pun intended. But moves at a good clip, much shorter than your average heavy Euro of its ilk. We finished our game with setup, rules explanation, and first time play and teardown in 3 hours, which is a long time, admittedly, but when an hour of that is rules explanation easily, and we were setting up the game for the first time, I suspect that time will go down considerably. And you're right, the theming is much better than a lot of games of this ilk. The actions are straightforward, it's the emergent complexity from combining those actions in an efficient way that makes things tricky. And the scoring elements, although not necessarily the most straightforward and intuitive in the world, are reasonably cohesive around launching cruises and having good cruise ships. And so it has a lot of things that I look for in Euros of this weight, but I'm not really too sure how enamored I am with it. I enjoyed my play, but I have concerns.
Yeah, so each cockpit of your ships, you can have up to three ships at the beginning, and each cockpit of your ship has sort of like a scoring opportunity. So that is, you know, something you can drive for. I'm wondering if it would benefit from having sort of like global missions and that would like steer you in a certain direction of what type of ship you wanted to build. And maybe that would freshen up the game a bit. You know what I mean?
Maybe. There are corporate goals.
Yeah.
And there's general goals to compete with other players with. Although that ended up to be, at least in our game, not worth a whole lot of points.
Yeah. They do come in randomly. So I'm wondering if we play with the, you know, not the baby's first Galactic Cruise, maybe that will freshen it up a little bit. There is a direct link to sort of also play Clinic this week. There's sort of a direct correlation here because the player interaction is sort of driven by the same mechanic as in Clinic. You have all these different clinics that you can open up.
Do tell.
And so there is a drive to get patients of different colors and different sicknesses, right? So it's the same as Galactic Cruise. There is, you know, different colors. So you sort of want to vary away from what the other players are doing, so the scarcity of these customers doesn't pertain to you. You know what I mean? There'll be a good flow. So same sort of mechanic there, this forced interaction.
Yeah, mechanically I think it's similar, but I think that in terms of play experience, they're very different. I remember when playing Clinic, and indeed one of the reasons why the late game was so unsatisfying was that there was such a scarcity of patients. Everyone was just desperately trying to get the patients in order to be able to keep their income level up. Especially in face of their expenses. In Galactic Cruise, there was usually enough pay.
There's a direct refill. What you take out immediately goes back in, unlike Clinic, where it only a standard number goes in every turn.
No, exactly. And consequently, there was never a huge competition for passengers in Galactic Cruise. More or less, everyone had access to what they needed, and it was usually just a difference between spending two or three of a given resource as opposed to four or five of a given resource. But,
yeah.
But by that point, we had the resources necessary, so it was all right.
Yeah, we only did play three players, and there is a bumping mechanism. You are doing it is a worker placement, and then there is a bumping mechanism. So I'm wondering, with four players, there might a scarcity might happen there, and the bumping mechanism might come into play more. So like
That's
you,
a good point.
I am looking forward to more plays. And we do have, this is all thanks to Warm Boy's copy, and he does have the expansions, so we'll see what the expansions have to bring as well.
Yeah. Overall, I'm vaguely positive. I'm trending towards positive, but as I say, I have my concerns.
I have bought multiple Desertas, hoping that, you know, this will be the one sort of very heavy, crunchy one that I'll enjoy, and this one definitely is ahead of all of those.
Agreed. Galactic Cruise by Kinson Key Games, published this year. Played a game called Twins. Okay, let's have a talk about Reiner Knizia Walker.
Yes, let's discuss. That, you know, he's an up-and-comer, right?
No,
good things coming
Stop
from
lying.
Him.
You're a liar. And the same thing is always mentioned, especially by hobbyists in the know as of now. It's like, oh, he's designed so many stinkers. This is true.
Fabulous bow tie.
Okay, sure. It is absolutely the case that Reiner Knizia has designed a fair number of uninspired games. Some of those uninspired games have even won awards. It happens. But there was a person in our group was directing such invective towards this one game called Twins, published by Oink Games. It was originally published in 1996, but a later edition by Oink Games, talking about how it was the worst game he'd ever played. And then sometimes you take it a step back and say, okay, not the worst I'd ever played, but certainly the worst Knizia game I've ever played. I'm like, aha, I'm always happy to play a Knizia game, and I'm even vaguely curious to see what is his worst design. So, very much was eager to play Twins. So this, as I said, this was designed and published in 1996. So this is after modern art and high society, but it was before Reiner Knizia was Reiner Knizia. So this is before Tigris and Euphrates, this is before Through the Desert. And so, at the time, maybe he was an up-and-comer, I don't know. So, once your silly joke was accurate, Walker, who knew? Twins is a hand management game that is not entirely unlike poker, because what happens is there are hand rankings of various pairs of cards, and over the course of a given round, you will play pairs of cards in sort of a blind bidding element. So, for example, round one might be the three lowest pairs have to contribute a point to the pot, and then round two might be the two best pairs take 3 points from the pot, and then round three might be the two lowest pay more to the pot and are now out for the rest of the round, and the next round is the highest pair wins the entire pot. And so there's this sort of ebb and flow between putting points in and taking points out. And so consequently, you have to look at your hand and figure, okay, am I in this for the long haul? Because, and this is very much how Twins does not play to my playstyle, if you want to win Twins, you're going to have to win the pot once or twice, it seems. At least once. On the other hand, though, you can be very conservative, look at it and say, I want to win that second round to grab those 3 points from the pot, but after that, I don't really care. I'm more than happy to get bounced out after that. I've got my money. I'll go home happy. And that's what I did, and I came in very, very much in first place after all the people who'd won a pot. So you really have to learn, know when you can stay in, know when you can go out, because you have to decide when you're going to play your best pairs. Is it the deepest decision space in the world? Absolutely not. Do you have a lot of the same weirdnesses of blind bidding when you're not vibing properly with the rest of the table and you play your best pair the same round that everyone else plays their best pair, and so you overpay and still lose? Absolutely. But it's a very, very quick, very simple game. The scoring's a little bit counterintuitive, and that part takes some explanation. But we came into this being told that this was the worst game ever made, or at least that was the joke. And it came out to be perfectly functional and with a couple decisions. Does it rank within some of the better, even Reiner Knizia quick push-your-luck filler games? No, not even remotely. But it was all right. So I'd even play it again. It was that quick. It was perfectly inoffensive, but definitely one of the many, many, many titles in Reiner Knizia's pedigree that doesn't need to be remembered, reprinted, or subject even of much acknowledgement or discussion. But when you're a past master game designer who's designed hundreds and hundreds of games, that's not the end of the world.
No, they can't all be great.
One could hope, anyway. So that's Twins by Reiner Knizia, published by Oink Games.
So like I said earlier, I showed a couple new people Clinic Deluxe Edition. This is on the stream, so if you want to hop over to our YouTube channel on the live tab, you could check this out. This is designed by Alben Viard and published by AV Studio Games. and you're pretty well running a hospital. And I think it does a great job of that. And I agree with, like, I realized how much I love this game and how much I hate exactly what Mark talked about. I can see, I think this is why he wanted to force sort of player interaction, that you wanted this big fight to get the customers, the patients.
It's a very telling Freudian slip. Yeah. Well done.
And want to get the patients into your hospital. So there's this, you know, push to do that. But then it just so takes away from the game. And everything else has such interesting choices. Because the turn order is so important, because of that, at the end of each round, you get to buy victory points. And then deciding when to do that, because your money comes in. And you have this one-time chance to buy victory points. It's not as though you can save all your money and buy a bunch of victory points at the end. You have to decide to do it then. So you want to buy just enough to try to stay in last place. Because if you're last place, you get to go first. Anyway, so that's a great decision. You get to design actually the blueprint of your whole hospital, where the rooms are. You get to go up in floors. You get this movement system because you have to move your doctors around and the patients around. And the more efficient you are at that, the less negative points you're going to get at the end. You get to open up different types of clinics. The fun part is the fact that we got to 37 expansions/modules, right? And then so they decided to go, the 38th one is a deck of cards, so you can just shuffle this up. We just played base clinic because two people were brand new. I just love the fact that there's so many different ways to mix it up. Just think of a way to change up a hospital. It's in there, which was funny because one of the players just threw out some random things and it's like, yeah, there's one for that. It was awesome. And he's, surely there's not, yep, there's one of those as well. Anyways.
Do any of the expansions mess with the supply of patients?
I'd have to go through them. I'm sure there is.
I'd be curious about some.
I'm sure there's like an outbreak where you double the patients. I had a quick thought this morning too. I'm wondering if the first patient, because what happens is that there's a row that has all the different departments, and every turn you draw one. Not sorry, every turn, there's three turns in a round, and every turn you draw a new patient for every department. My thought was that if that first patient is a white one, then you draw another one for that thing.
Okay.
And I thought that would change it up just enough, I think, to bring a little bit more into the system. But anyway, I love Clinic Deluxe. I am once again going to try to go. There's also a whole campaign book that leads you through a story. It's like, oh, you want to open a new hospital in this quaint little village. And it brings you through and slowly introduces these 37 modules.
Wild.
And he's still making more.
Yeah.
There is one already out. It's like the 69th. There's a blue edition and a pink edition. And on Board Game Geek, there's already the 7th extension. It doesn't say what's in it, but it's yet another full expansion for
Strong
Clinic.
Can't stop, won't stop energy for,
yeah,
Clinic.
It's just more and more stuff.
Yeah, as we've been discussing, I like a whole lot about Clinic. Building out your clinic is cool. The efficiency puzzle of making sure that all the patients and doctors don't have to travel much inside your clinic is really, really, really neat. But ultimately, that endgame patient scarcity, where, you know, you've built up all these facilities, but you don't really have a whole lot of choice about how to run them anymore or how to expand. You've pretty much expanded as far as you're going to go. You're just trying to scrabble up as many sick people as you can.
Oh, and then you realize there's no reason to expand it because there's just not enough patients. So why expand your,
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating because everything else about it is so good. And then it's pulled back by that one part. Clinic.
Played Station Fall. This was the choice of Il Lupo. Il Lupo has left us, Walker.
Oh.
Kingston is now without Il Lupo. And
sad.
Such is my enthusiasm and affection for Il Lupo that even though I would rather not play Station Fall, I didn't even say anything for like the first 5 minutes of the game about how I have serious problems with Station Fall. Station Fall is one of the very rarities in our hobby. There's a lot of games that are kind of like Clinic or kind of like Galactic Cruise, the heavyweight Euro that's mostly multiplayer solitaire about economic efficiency. And then there are the heavyweight games with dense, thick rule books full of weird outre combinations and strange possibilities and exigencies that is meant to tell a wacky story about hijinks. The juxtaposition of hijinks and dense rule set is a tricky, tricky path to tread, and I will freely grant that Station Fall does it better than many. There were lots of games in the 80s and 90s that were all about doing this kind of thing. The things that sometimes the historical con sim gamers would say were beer and pretzels games. But when you're playing, spending 3 hours playing a game, I think we're well past beer and pretzels. Anyway, setting all that aside, that was my token back in my day comment. Station Fall, I will freely grant, is more Station Fall than any other game that has ever been. And we were playing the team variant. I have misgivings about the team variant. The fundamental structure of Station Fall is that every player represents a shadowy cabal of interests, and they have a couple of characters that they kind of sort of are theirs. And at the end of the game, you will score for one of those characters. Although in the middle of the game, you can flip and pivot and suddenly control a different character instead. It's called the Schrodinger's Reveal, because heaven forfend anything in Station Fall have terms that make sense. But anyhow, in the team game, you don't have that liberty. You don't have that flexibility of saying, okay, this is my horse, but I might be able to swap horses later on. In the team version, you get dealt three character cards at the outset, and each one controls one, and then the third is basically a bonus, and you sum your scores at the end. Although I appreciate the dynamics that the team play gives, I didn't quite like how restrictive it is in terms of the characters, because I enjoy a lot about Station Fall, but it's difficult to take the game seriously because of how arbitrary it is fundamentally. There's a sort of equilibrium in Station Fall. The theme of the game is you're on a space station and it's plummeting into the atmosphere and you have to escape nominally. A lot of characters don't care about escaping, though. A lot of characters care about carnage. And so these characters, and it's almost impossible to have a setup of the game with at least one of them, might just start braining people with wrenches for no reason, or just because dead people help their score at the end of the day.
What? Sorry, how many characters? I just want to do
73,000.
No, not quite, but 8? Is it 8? Not 18.
Yeah, in some setups. It depends on the number of players, but
anyway, just so how people know how this works, there's, say, 12 to 18 characters, and all of their rules are on the side of the board. And when it's your turn, you get to control any one of these 18 characters.
Yeah, more or less.
You have no idea who anybody is. You know who you are. You secretly know, like Mark said, that two of these characters could potentially be yours at the end of the game.
Yep.
And so you're manipulating these 18 characters around this board, doing all sorts of, I shouldn't say even in the ship, because you can jump out the ship with a jetpack and do other things. And so, yes, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I just wanted them to
get the feel of what this...
Helpful clarification. The thing is, as I say, it's balanced on an equilibrium, and I have seen so many games of Station Fall, not all of them admittedly, but so many of them just go sideways, because if your character has now been brained upside the head by some random wandering psychopath, your incentive to keep the game at an even keel is kind of gone. So there are some characters who are incentivized towards chaos, and then there are other characters who are incentivized towards order, but they have no ability to enforce order because more or less anybody can pull a ripcord and start the murder fest. And once the murder fest begins, who knows? So in this particular case, I was teamed up with a Lupo, and two of the characters we had were two of those characters that are incentivized towards chaos. There's the cyborg and the engineer. And now you may think, oh, an engineer. No. Engineer is not a good title for this person. They get points for releasing the core and having everything go nuclear, and they don't get any points for survival. The moment you have all these characters that do not score points for survival, you know that something's going to go sideways. And I looked at these characters and I basically said, yeah, we've won. Like, that's it. There's no two ways about it. We doubled the next nearest score. Because all we needed to do was wander around and break stuff. And look, as anybody who knows anything about recent politics or the world in general, it is so much easier to break stuff than it is to keep things together. And frankly, Station Fall is kind of delightfully crazy when things are falling apart. But the problem is you can only get there if you don't care at all about anything resembling it as a competitive experience. Are there games that manage crazy and still manage to be relatively competitively solid? It's tricky. I would argue, though, that if you've got a large number of people or even a smaller number of people and want something that's got a reasonably solid rule set, Cosmic Encounter is going to get you there much better, I think. My games of Cosmic seemed much more deterministic, but equally interesting as many games of Station Fall. It's definitely a vibe. There are heavy gamers that would never in a million years touch something like Station Fall. And there are lots of light gamers that normally wouldn't play something as dense as Station Fall, but are willing to go along for the ride. It's a very particular thing. It's not my flavor of thing, though.
But you're going to have stories.
You're going to have stories.
And you're going to have stories that you're going to remember. Like, remember that time there was, like, 8 of us trying to get on the escape pod? And then the braining started, and there was bodies thrown out of the skate pod, and then bodies thrown back into the skate pod.
Yeah, no, it's true. The stories almost always involve a wrench in someone's cranium, though. I mean, yeah, I do remember some stories. I remember some events from the most recent game, but most of it involves a wrench. So, in fact, the turning point of the session was when a player brought their character thinking that they were safe from the depredations of the aforementioned wrench because they had a helmet. Most of the time, indeed, you are protected from being brained if you have a helmet. The exception is, you know, a line of text on one of the aforementioned more than a dozen characters to the side of the board that says that if somebody reveals as the cyborg and has a wrench, they can down somebody even if they have a helmet that one time. And that's what determined the course of the game. I revealed as the cyborg. I brained to the ground. He was sad. He was legit bummed because he didn't know about that weird corner case. And one of the other Station Fall enthusiasts shrugged and said, yeah, that's Station Fall. It's like, yeah, that's the game. That right there. I didn't know that particular combination could occur. And I dare say that most of the other veterans of Station Fall at the table were like, oh, I forgot about that interaction. Of course you did. There are too many.
Yeah, too many. It was probably a really fun 5 hours, though, right?
No, I was surprised at how quick it was. We were in and out in about 2.5 hours.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, it wasn't bad at all. It was a very, very good clip, and it's hard to begrudge it too much. It's just not trying to do something that I think is the kind of hobby game that I want to play. I don't mind crazy fun things happening. I don't mind rules dense, but the two together just aren't my preferred version of game. I do like games where you're kind of riding a sea of chaos. Senji, to a certain extent, is like that, although it's balanced considerably by the negotiation. Cosmic Encounter is very much like that. Cosmic Frog is very much like that. I would infinitely rather play games more in that vein.
True, and it's so hard to get it to the table because you have no idea if it's going to hit or not.
Yeah.
And then the fact that the teach is so brutal.
It's one of those games where you basically have two choices. And this is a bit of a false dichotomy. You can either give the most superficial explanation and say, we'll cover everything else as it comes up, in which case you're talking about 15, 20 minutes. Or you feel the need to at least gesture towards all, even just the major things that could happen without even going into detail. It's like, okay, there are these things called firebombs. They happen over there. We'll go into detail later. We can eject the engine core. That'll cause the ship to blow up in 4 turns. We'll get to that later.
The death alien might be released.
The death alien might be. And that is going to take you 45 minutes to an hour. And even then, everyone's going to get so confused. Anyway, I could complain and praise Station Fall for hours, and I have in other contexts. Not my bag. I understand why other people love it, though. And under normal circumstances, I would have said, I am willing to do this thing, but I would strongly prefer something else. But for Lupo, I just can't say no. So that was Station Fall, designed by Matt Eklund, published by Ion Game Design in 2023. That is Matt Eklund. Matt Eklund.
I got Great Western Trail New Zealand back to the table. And in my opinion, it is the best of all Great Western Trails. You're collecting sheep instead of cows. There's also...
That's the reason?
No. And there's also a whole...
It's the first thing
you said.
Okay. It's Period. The best one because you collect...
Period.
Okay.
Moving on. You collect sheep instead of cows. How's right. that?
Yeah, that works.
There's also a ship that you're moving around. The biggest hook in this particular edition is that it's sort of a deck builder. But
they're all basically deck builders.
But I mean, like, it amplifies that to 100.
It does more deck buildery things with the action cards. Yes, I'd forgotten about that.
And unfortunately, this makes the setup a little brutal because not only now you're setting up Great Western Trail, now you're also setting up a deck builder at the same time. You know, you're picking which random cards you're going to have for this particular game, and you're getting all of them in piles around the board, and then you're having to explain to people what all the different cards do. Anyway, so there's a lot more to this, but like I said, I feel as though it is the best of the group. This is designed by Alexander Pfister, much like all of the other Great Western Trail games, and put out by Eggerspiel. And what you do in Great Western Trail is you're sort of creating a rondelle, maybe. It is
one of the things you can do.
It starts with neutral buildings that you're moving your cowboy around. You're allowed to put out your own buildings.
Are you still a cowboy in
New
Zealand?
No. So you're moving around this rondelle. You get to put out some of your own buildings as well if you wish. I didn't put out any. That is one way you can score a bunch of points. And when you get to the end of the trail, you trade in your sheep for money.
So they can go to the petting zoo?
Just so.
Okay.
Yes. And they also adds in another hook to this is that you get to shear the sheep as well. So it works almost exactly the same. What you're trying to do is you're trying to manipulate your hand so you have different sheep. And at the end, you're trading them for one value, or halfway through, you're trading them in for their wool value. Two different things on the card now, and two different areas all over the board to score either for wool or score for trading in the sheep themselves. You're moving the ship around, unlocking new areas, getting new cards. There is also bonus tiles you're getting now instead. So there's a whole bunch more to this particular version of Great Western Trail, but in the end, I enjoy it the most.
I have to agree, I don't have a whole lot of experience with New Zealand in particular, but I think that when it comes to the base game, the original Great Western Trail, the one where you're sending cows in the wrong direction, the base game has its deficiencies. The expansion kind of fixes some of those, but in the process makes it a little more complicated and there's a little bit too much focus on the expansion material. I think that Great Western Trail New Zealand does a pretty good job of sticking to the strengths of the core formula and elaborating on it in interesting ways. I've only played it a couple times, but I do think that it is a solid evolution of the formula.
Great Western Trail New Zealand.
Played Schottentotten 2, more Reiner Knizia goodness. This is a redevelopment of Schottentotten, which was kind of republished as Battle Line. That's the one that's more commonly available in English. And it introduces asymmetry into Schottentotten. And I have to say, now having played Schottentotten 2 a number of times, I think I prefer the original one, because one of the cool things in Schottentotten is this element of proof. You can prove the cards on your side of a contested flag are better than anything the opponent can do. And I really think that's cool. It's an interesting element of card tracking, of trying to play out card possibilities so that they can be stronger or weaker depending on the various vicissitudes of how the board shakes out, of reacting to the ability to play a card in other flags, and sometimes the desire to play a card just so that it hits the table so you can prove that the opponent won't get that card and thereby win another flag. It's really well done. In Schottentotten 2, only one of the two players has to do that. Similarly, one of the big pressures in Schottentotten, which is very common amongst Reiner Knizia card games, is the desperate desire to pass. Wishing you could pass, because every time you play a card in Schottentotten, you're committing either to a new formation to a flag or possibly spoiling an existing formation that you were trying to complete on spec. You know, you play the red 5, you play the red 6, you hope to get that red 7, but before the red 7 can show up, you just play a 7 of a different color there and accept the fact that now it's just a straight rather than a straighted color, and you hope that that's going to be strong enough, but the alternative playing everywhere else was just too painful. Similarly, that pressure kind of only exists for one of the two players in Schottentotten 2. For reasons of asymmetry, one of the two players can pull back all the cards from their side, but only one of the two. And so what you have is a game that is more complicated, and at the same time has fewer of the interesting elements for both players, net-net. Now, I'm not going to say that all the asymmetric elements in Schottentotten 2 are for the worse. We now have the case that different flags want different kinds of formations played to them or have different number of cards you can play there. That part is fine. I have no objection to that whatsoever. But overall, I would much rather play the base game of Schottentotten. And frankly, I find it a little bit disappointing that they didn't include the rules for the basic game of Schottentotten in the box, because all the components are there. You have all the cards you need. You have flags. You can just stipulate that the tiles are flags now, or substitute in a coin or something else. And it's a little bit of an oversight that when Yellow published Schottentotten 2, they didn't include the base game rules. Maybe they don't have the rights to them. I don't know. But suffice to say, you can play the base game of Schottentotten with Schottentotten 2, and that is probably what I'm going to be doing going forward, because that card play tension and and the interesting element of proving that you've won a fight even before it's over are the two things that I find directly appealing about it, in addition to all the standard hand management and push-your-luck goodness that you might expect from a hand management card game. But I think that the base game does it so much better. So that's Shot and Taunton 2 by Reiner Knizia in 2020.
Does it have the card cancellation in the first one? Where you play 0 to cancel the 12? No? Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay, but the circumstances... Okay, so in Shot and Taunton 2, instead of the cards going from 1 to 9 in the original one, they go from 0 to 11, and the zeros cancel out the 11 of the same color. So if your opponent has played the 11 on their side, and you're able to get the 0, which is a chicken, of the same color, you can play it, and then both those cards leave. But you need to pull that card, the opponent needs to have played the card, there needs to be room on your side of the match for that to happen, etc., etc. It's an interesting possibility, but I don't necessarily know that it pays off. And frankly, I'm not entirely certain that the base game could not accommodate that element if you wanted to. So frankly, if that's something you would miss, it might be worth giving it a try in the base game.
Yeah, Shot and Taunton, it's really good.
Yeah, it's worth emphasizing, though, thank you. I would still happily play Shot and Taunton 2. I think it's a step back for the original, but the original is one of the best Euro two-player card games, I think. And it's extraordinarily well done and really, really enjoyable. If you've played Lost Cities, I think Shot and Taunton is sort of the more hobbyist gamer version of Lost Cities. It has a lot of those same tensions, but with a much, much simpler scoring system, much less mathy, and much more direct player interaction. It's very, very tense and head-to-head. Walker showed me Core of Discovery, a game set in the world of Manifest Destiny. This is by Jay Cormier and Senfun Lim, published by Off the Page Games. It is a sort of deduction game masquerading as an adventure game. You are going through these nodes of a map. There are rules for what nodes are going to be next to various other nodes. And all the while you have this, basically the only gamification of it is this very, very, very stark resource drain of challenge cards that need to be completed on a schedule, of minotaurs that you need to kill.
Not flying minotaurs.
I was promised flying minotaurs.
I'm sorry.
All right? And this may be the greatest betrayal I've ever experienced since my parents' divorce.
I'm very sorry.
And my father looked at me square in the eye and said, I'm leaving because of you.
Yikes.
And this is worse. So, no flying minotaurs. It's all just resource scarcity, basically. You try to figure out the resources you need. You look at the map and say, okay, well, it could be here, it could be there. By process of elimination, let's try this other one. It's fine. I normally don't like deduction games. It makes me feel like I'm studying for the LSATs again, and I start worrying about Jason and Susie, and they show up with different colored sweaters and who they're going to sit next to and what they're eating, and I feel like I'm filling out a spreadsheet.
They left at 2 and walked 5 miles an hour. And
oh, that's just math. That part's fine. I got no problem with that part. It's the filling out of the spreadsheet of the combination. It's like when we were setting it up, Chip the Third said, so this is basically like Sudoku. And I thought that was a pretty good analogy, frankly. Sudoku is a deduction puzzle. It's not really a math puzzle. And the same is true of Core of Discovery. I thought that the artwork was relatively well done. Apparently it's from a comic series.
Graphic novel, yeah.
Yeah, that is very much... I didn't know the setting of the graphic novel, but it is very much Manifest Destiny, although apparently this time with minotaurs. I don't know.
Non-flying minotaurs.
Rubbing it in. You're not going to let this wound... you keep reopening it every time, rubbing salt in my wound of non-flying minotaurs. There's some discussion about whether the minotaurs were sapient, and clearly they are because they're using tools and they have jewelry. But anyway, I don't know why we can't make peace with the minotaurs, but that, I guess, isn't consistent with Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny is not about making friends.
They're angry because they don't fly.
So, it kind of feels like a resource efficiency game coupled with a kind of positional abstract, really. It didn't feel very much like a deduction game in the same way that Almost Innocent feels. Cooperative deduction games are still the minority in the genre. It was all right. It was fine.
Yeah, for the time it takes and the rules teach it is very low. You know, it's very easy to get going. The sort of secretly sliding the map into the thing and putting all the nodes out is kind of painful, but the overall teach is low enough and you get going quick enough that I don't mind it too bad.
Yeah, didn't really grab me. I felt a little bit put out by the resource requirements interacting with the map in a strange way. Like, we ended up with a whole bunch of challenge cards that all of a sudden desperately needed mud. and there was just very little mud to be had on the board. First of all, mud being a resource, I'm a little confused, but setting all that aside. So I'm not exactly sure how we could have done things differently unless we had known at the outset there would be a strong mud tension somewhere in the second day. I'm not sure. But it was, as you say, the rules explanation is very, very simple, and the setup isn't too onerous. I'd be willing to try it again, but I wasn't a huge fan.
Agreed.
That was Core of Discovery. And those are the games we played last week. Now, a quick break to pay some bills.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Whether you're looking to buy your dream home or rent a sweet apartment, give Redfin your gotta-have-it wish list of property features, and you'll receive real-time notifications tailored just for you. Ready to see it up close and personal? Scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Don't wait to find your perfect match. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
And we're back. On to the news and why it doesn't matter. Fromage, Walker.
Fromage.
Fromage. One of the things that I said in a review of Fromage that I wasn't a huge fan of was that I felt that the order cards were a little underpowered. I felt that the effort required to go get the card and then get the precise kind of cheese that was necessary to satisfy the order cards wasn't quite worth the point value that they were. And it is also the case that apparently the designer agrees because there are now changes to Fromage.
Interesting.
Anyone who has backed Fromaggio will get free replacements for the affected components. There is going to be paste-ups available for free on the website, and you can also get at a nominal cost little replacement stickers. They're fixing some of the asymmetric buildings or modifying the values, and they're also making order cards worth slightly more points.
Interesting.
I'm a big fan of this changes. We're still big fans of Fromage. Great game, wonderful conceit, and I'm glad that they are tinkering a little bit around the edges, and I'm looking forward to Formaggio and the free fixes.
Well, Board and Dice announced a new tea game from Daniel Tassini. This is co-designed by Antonio Pirelli and will be released in 2025. It's called Tea and Chia, and it looks great. It has like sort of the building of the Great Wall in the background and another tea game, another Daniel Tassini game. I'm all in for that.
Burned, Walker.
Burned.
Burned.
Print to, is it print on demand now?
No, not quite, but it will be soon. There is going to be a crowd sale on the Game Crafter. This was announced by Burnt Island Games not too long ago. They say stay tuned for further updates. Burned is a two-player cat-and-mouse kind of spy hidden movement thing that both Walker and I are big, big fans of. I was very disappointed that it wasn't able to get crowdfunded, and I am extremely happy that Burned will be able to be released to a wider audience. I sincerely recommend keeping your eyes open. We will definitely announce it here in the news when the crowd sale is open at the Game Crafter. I'm looking forward to picking up a copy of Burned. Finally, open registration is open for SwagCon, that is Congrès. So Very Wrong About Games, Fun Times, Good Vibes Only, Trans Rights to Human Rights Board Game Jamboree, July 25th to the 27th in Kingston, Ontario. You can buy tickets at Eventbrite. There is a great crowd already signed up, but there is room for more if you are so inclined. There is a link to the tickets in the episode notes below. And that is the news, and why it doesn't matter. We're now going to close out the episode with our topic. The joy, the agony, the appropriateness, the inappropriateness of pulling levers, a.k.a. Mark sounds more harsh than he means to be.
The role of experimentation and improvisation in board games.
Absolutely. So a number of people, we talked about this in Furnace Time, but for those of you who do not listen to Furnace Time, there was a bit of discussion on various fora about people concerned about whether or not in a competitive game they're, quote unquote, holding up their end. When I expressed the view, and this is a view that I still sincerely hold, that among the social contract of playing a board game, that you have an obligation to pursue your own interests and not to engage in random moves, allow me to assert that by random, I mean genuinely random. I mean, like, rolling a die to see what action you're going to take, which is an activity we have seen before at our table. Or deliberately doing something not to further your interest, but to consciously further the interest of someone else when there's no exogenous reason to. If you do something and someone theoretically asks you, why did you do the thing? And the answer involves some possibility of some output somewhere that involves your pursuing your own victory, then I'm cool. I'm not like why'd you do that? It's like, well, there's some possibility that if this happens and then this happens and this other thing happens and it rains on Tuesday and this other thing happens, I might get a point out of that. Oh, okay. Not what I would have done, but that's cool. If instead the answer is, I don't know, that's different. That is slightly different. And so frankly, I'm not one of those people who, when playing Puerto Rico, for example, this is the classic instance, and someone takes a role that I think isn't the right one to take, I'm not going to crap all over your decisions. That's not me. Make that very, very clear. I am specifically just foreclosing the attitudes where someone plays completely randomly or explicitly to torpedo their own chances to benefit somebody else. That's the stuff that I think runs counter to the social contract. Not that you have to be good enough to sit down at a certain table. Some people regard board gaming as a competitive aspect first and a social event second. I think that is, I'm not going to say that that's the wrong way to do it, but that's not the way that I approach it at all. I'm not training for the World Board Gaming Championships. I would never go to the World Board Gaming Championships, like compete in the World Board Gaming Championships. For me, this is a social event first and a competitive event second. And if anything, that second aspect serves to reinforce the first rather than the other way around. But anyway.
And like I was saying
so
earlier,
that's my coda.
Yeah, like I was saying earlier, is that sometimes people learn by watching other people play, and sometimes people learn by just doing their own thing. So even if they see another person doing something and they take something that they needed, that's not their fault. They're learning by doing their own thing. It's not their fault that they're not watching what's going on at the entire table. Some people just play differently than others.
Absolutely. I revel in the long shot, the risky gambit, the unexpected pivot. These are joyous, joyous things. And I would never in a million years want to stand in the way of someone's joy of discovery. And I would never want to add to a perceived kind of social anxiety about not being quote unquote good enough, end quote, at a certain game to play it. That is nonsense. If you're playing at a competitive bridge tournament, fine. Worry about whether or not you're good enough to be partnered with somebody. That's a different thing entirely.
Oh, by the way, you're not.
I'm cut from the team?
I'm just saying, if you're wondering, then you're in a lot of trouble.
I don't think that's true. I mean it. Like, I've seen a lot of people who've expressed the social anxiety. It's like, well, I'll play, but I warn you, I'm not any good.
No, sometimes. I'm talking about bridge specifically.
Yeah, okay, fine. Okay. Yeah, I hear right. You. No, it's just, I've heard this all the time. It's like, you say to somebody at an open game night, maybe this is someone you know, maybe this is someone you don't know. Hey, do you want to play X? And like, I don't know, I'm not very good at games like this. Don't sweat it. It's okay.
Agreed. I have some games listed here.
Go for it.
That I felt really fall into the experimentation sort of bucket.
I've got some too, yeah.
All right, good. I was wondering if I had wasted my time.
No.
And I feel as though Mind Clash does this best, in my opinion.
Really?
Yes, they have games like Tricarion and Anachrony that give you these wide choices. Like in Tricarion, you have these multiple trick books that you can delve into each game and do totally different things. And in Anachrony, they have all these different machines and things that you can build that totally change the way your game evolves. And so I feel as though they sort of feed into that sort of feeling of experimentation and finding different ways to play.
Anachrony, maybe. Mind Clash, but I don't know if that this is definitely part of the core Mind Clash experience, and I certainly don't think this is true of Tricarion. Here's why. When I think of playing Tricarion, sure, there's a lot of different tricks you could decide to pursue. I'm sorry, illusions, Michael.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. And that certainly provides for a variety. And yeah, from game to game, you're going to might have a slightly different experience by virtue of that. But when I think of Tricarion, I think of one of those games where all your ducks need to be in a row. You need to get the A to get the B to get the C. And if you're one off, you're not going to be able to get anywhere. You need all of it in order to do the thing. and if you're slightly off. So there's no room for improvisation. There's no room for experimentation. You have a list of things you need to get done in order to perform that illusion. And if you don't, well, sucks to be you.
Well, I'm saying the sort of repertoire of illusions that you choose and how they interact with each other is a way that you can change things up.
I guess, but to me it's just more like, what are the plans that I'm going to pursue this time? Rather, maybe we're just talking about different
yeah.
scopes, but it's a different vibe as far as I'm concerned. So let me give you an example of one of the games that I had in mind, and that's Millennium Blades. Millennium Blades, you pretty much have to embrace the joy of experimentation, because otherwise you can all too easily, and I've seen this in a number of games, especially when I play, because I'm very conservative by nature, and I'm not very good at embracing the joy of discovery. It's a character flaw, generally. It's easy to stick with your starting deck, because you get this pre-canned, it interacts with itself, it triggers off of its own things. It's weak, but it works, right? And in Millennium Blades, there's this massive universe of cards that you can swap in and out of your deck more or less at will. And it is up to you to craft a new group of cards that sing well together. And there's thousands of ways you can do that. And so you really can just look at a single card and say, I'm going to build a deck around that card and see what happens. I'm going to say, let's see what happens if I build only cards with this trait or this other trait, and play different decks and experiment around with that kind of thing. It's wild. And it's meant to evoke the sort of broad meta experience of playing a collectible card game. So instead of building a variety of decks and participating in tournaments over the course of a year or so, in a game of Millennium Blades, you'll have the opportunity to build a variety of decks and play pseudo-tournament thingies. And that's one of the reasons why I like Millennium Blades, because it forces me to get out of my conservative comfort zone and play around with stuff and pull levers and experiment and have the joy of discovery.
The same sort of feeling, I think, is what you're going to get out of Sacra Arms the more you play. Because what you're doing in Sacra Arms is you're taking these little mini decks of fighters, and you always have to choose two, and finding new ways to combine different fighters and discovering new things that different fighters do when paired together is a fantastic feeling as well.
Yeah. The same is true very often of, you know, pivoting off of those, because both Millennium Blades and Sacra Arms in some ways are kind of aping the deck construction aspect of Magic the Gathering. The same is true of any deck construction game. The same can be true of well-done tabletop miniatures games. Like, I'm going to play around with this new kind of army. I want to see. I remember when I first got started in tabletop miniatures games, and I was playing the D&D collectible miniatures game, because that's what was played locally. It's the same old story. You play what people play locally.
Yes.
And one of my favorite armies, it was not very successful at all, but it was entirely premised around a single question. Can I get an incredibly cheap unit to be able to do monstrous quantities of damage? And so I built an army around a concatenating series of buffs that when they all overlapped in precisely the right way, there was this group of cannon fodder units that suddenly started becoming monsters. Now, take any one of those elements out and they're all useless again. But I had so much fun tinkering around with that list and playing that list and watching my opponents discover how it worked. And at their best, miniatures games can work that way.
So in the vein of matching heroes together, it's the same thing as matching gods together in Spirit Island. Seeing how different gods interact with each other and how they can play off each other and how they can help each other and how, you know, when you take certain spells will change up how
powers.
It works. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the sheer universe of different powers and seeing how a new power can interact with an aspect of another spirit, or they're not gods, they're spirits. This is actually important.
I'm very sorry.
No, it's okay. It's just, you know, the universe is a very particular tone, and for people who take it seriously, then they're spirits, not gods. And so how a new power that you haven't played with much before might interact with a different power, or even with a different spirit ability, or what have you, tons of interesting and weird combinations, particularly with some of the more asymmetric spirits, like finding new push abilities for Ocean's Hungry Grasp is always a joy.
And another one to a very less extent, because we have already talked about it today, and the fact that you don't get to fight with these ships very often, but in Eclipse, you have your player board, and it gives you this blueprint of all your ships. And you get to sock in all these different weapons and force fields and engines, and you get to manipulate how your whole fleet works differently for each game, even though you don't get to use it that much, is a very satisfying and fun feeling as well.
Absolutely. new combinations and how you might get an alien artifact that really opens up a pre-existing ship design. And I really think that there are lots of... So these have mostly been highly interactive games so far to varying extent. But I think that at their best, multiplayer solitaire games can also give people the space to just mess around and pull levers and see what happens. And I think that A Feast for Odin is a really good example of this. You get to mess around in this big sandbox full of lots of different ways to get resources, lots of different things to do, and maybe you've never settled that colony before. Maybe you've never really messed around with conquering in this particular way. Go ahead, give it a shot. And this is another thing relating back to my coda of people worried about, you know, suboptimal play. So many Euros are multiplayer solitaire, and suboptimal play is not going to affect anybody negatively anyway, so it's not really a big deal. Like, I struggle to think of any way that someone could mess up a game of A Feast for Odin, really. Like, even if you tried, I don't know how you'd be able to do it. Now, again, we don't necessarily think that multiplayer solitaire games are the pinnacle of the hobby experience. Sometimes it's a detriment, and I do think that A Feast for Odin is kind of riding that line, but it's a little better with the Norwegians, and there's just so much cool stuff to do, and just the joy of pulling different levers and finding different things to do can be even completely divorced from wild quantities of asymmetric powers that we've been talking about in these other games.
So I get that same feeling from games like Robinson Crusoe and Frostpunk, where it's a cooperative sort of, you know, keep your people alive, scavenging type game. And there's so many different options you can do, like which buildings are you going to build this time? How are we going to deal with these different combos? Like, we should try, you know, making, you know, we should try building our hut first this time. And, you know, weather, getting ready for the weather as opposed to, you know, getting food or venturing out into the island. Different ways you can, you know, play the game each time you do it.
It's hard. I haven't played Robinson Crusoe in a while. I should probably play it again soon. I had a couple of kind of middling experiences with it upon its first release, and I haven't gone back to it too much, but I really should. But my memory of Frostpunk is very much that the resource demands were so huge that there wasn't a big sandbox in which to play. It's like, we desperately need this. Well, I could go and do some other things, or I can just desperately scrabble for the resource that we desperately need.
True. It is a little bit of that Sky Team where, you know, you only have four dice and you know, three of them are allocated no matter what.
Yeah.
But it's where you allocate, you know, that one die every turn and try to get that little bit of an advantage, right? It's like, oh, I built the library and, you know, it might seem foolish, but now we'll have all these other options, right?
And I don't mean this as a criticism, but like, someone might look at the components of a game like Core of Discovery, which is about a hidden map that you gradually reveal over the course of the game, and say, oh, this is a game about like pulling levers and the joy of discovery. No, it's not. It's really not. And that's not a criticism. It is a game about resource scarcity and trying to infer where the thing you need is.
Yeah, that's why, right? When I talked about it the first time, you have this disconnect, right? Where it gives you this adventure feel, but it's not. It's you know.
Not everything needs to be that way. My ultimate point is that resource scarcity, this desperate, like, it's one of the reasons why A Feast for Odin feels so much more open than Agricola. In Agricola, far more of your time is just worried about feeding your family. In A Feast for Odin, feeding your family is borderline trivial, but that gives you the ability to mess around with all this other stuff. If it is the case that in a co-op game or anything else, your primary needs are survival, there's not going to be a whole lot of lever pulling, because mostly you're just occupied with survival.
Now I have a list of improvisational games.
Okay.
Like Codenames, where you assess the people that are around you, you sort of get a feel of what you can do to sort of manipulate the board into the way you want. Like, how do they know you enough that if you say certain things, they will be able to link these words together? Do they know when you say seven, then, well, you know, obviously, it won't be that, but this is the closest thing, and he's going for it, so...
Seven's a lot.
I know.
Yeah, all these open-form social word games where you can make truly interesting connections, and there's literally endless possibilities because language is definitionally infinite. It's wonderful.
And then there's bluffing games. That's why I put Star Wars Rebellion back in here. It's sort of, you know where your base is.
Huh.
And so you try to, you know, you might pretend to focus your troops in an area. You know, you're not obviously you're not going to leave it undefended, but you pretend there's all this action over
here.
I'm told
that's the smartest thing to do.
And cockroach poker, it's the same sort of thing. It's this inflection in your voice. It's it's this plain, it's this aloof, you give this aloof sort of
I had
thing
no idea.
As you pass cards.
You had so much technique when administering swirlies while bullying people.
Cockroach poker. Poker is fantastic. It's such a great game. Just the way you can manipulate the table, I really enjoy that. And then there's games that I don't enjoy for the same reason. Like social deduction games like Blood on the Clock Tower, where somehow people get inferences and ways to figure out what's going on when there is no real solid information, yet somehow they infer it in a way, and I can't do that. And so I'm glad they have fun doing that.
Yeah, it's weird. I feel like Blood on the Clock Tower doesn't give me any of the room to pull levers to find new ways to solve the problem, because I feel like I'm just laboring under the dense interconnected web of noise, misdirection, and nonsense introduced by the roles and the storyteller pulling the strings. I feel like it's the storyteller that gets to pull levers in a game of Blood on the Clock Tower, not the actual players.
Yeah, I know. I've been talking to people that have played Blood on the Clock Tower, and I always...
Well, more than we have.
Yes, more than I have, and I complain about there being no solid information. Apparently, even though there is solid information, that's not true either, because the storyteller
can just
say, no, the little things that you thought were true aren't actually true because I had to manipulate the game in a certain way that now all your information is false anyway. Hope you're having fun.
Yeah, so if there's anybody that gets to pull levers, it's the storyteller in Blood on the Clock Tower. That's been my experience. I know a lot of people love it. That's fine, but not my experience. I'm glad we could just spend some time talking about the joy of discovery.
So I hope we cleared everything up.
Everything's clear now, I think. Oh, like, that's fine. We don't have to come to definitive conclusions about everything. I'm glad I was able to correct the record and talk about a style of play that is genuinely joyous when it works. Not a whole lot of designs lean into it. And one, as I say, that is all too often counter to my impulses. So I appreciate it when a game really encourages me to lean into it.
And this is what I tend to do on first plays almost every time, is that I just try to pull as many levers as I can, or I find one particular lever that I would like to see can bring me to close to, you know, that I'm not in last place.
Yep, absolutely. You're much better at that than I am. And that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to spend the time with us. We hope to see you again soon. Until then, please exercise self-care, take care of yourselves, take care of the hobby, and as always, thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.